Good morning and welcome. It's the second hour of the Bible study on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. KFUO is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner, your host. Thanks for being with us. Thanks again to Pastor David Boies Clare for the lesson in Hosea. This is interesting stuff. And as I pointed out during that hour, lots and lots of applications for today. Now, a very, very special program for you today. Now, normally we call this Ask the Pastor, but we're going to break format for just a little bit. I went to Gary Duncan and spoke with him, and I said, you know, there is so much going on in the world that relates to Islam. We really need an opportunity to maybe digest a little bit of what's going on, what you hear in the news, how true is it, what is the theology of Islam, what does it really portend for its relations with the West. And I said, you know what, I've got a friend down in Atlanta who is an expert at all things Islamic, especially when it comes to eschatology and things like the Mahdi, or their version of, I guess, the saving prophet that comes back at the end of the time. We call that the eschaton, or Islamic eschatology. And his name is Dr. Timothy R. Furnish. Now, if you've listened to Studio A, you've probably heard him many times. If you're meeting him for the first time, use him and his work as a resource. He's a professor, a writer, as an expert, as I said, in Islamic theology and history. And he writes for the History News Network, and you can also find some of his pieces at Pajamas Media. Has his own website. It's MahdiWatch.org. And I thought what we would do today, Tim, is do a little primer on what Islam is, and then maybe talk about the events that have been going on this week. And you can bring some clarity to a very cloudy subject. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to do it, Roland.
Now, you, just so the folks get to know you, tell me a little bit about your background. And you actually spent some time here at Concordia Seminary, didn't you?
I did. I did a Master of Arts in Religion there. Back, the first Bush administration. First Bush administration, 89. Before that, I was in the Army. I was an Arabic linguist in the Army when I was enlisted. And then after seminary, I went to Ohio State and did a PhD in Islamic history. So then I was a college professor for a while, and I now do consulting with the government and with the military and do writing on topics dealing with the Islamic world.
So every once in a while you head off to the War College and you teach?
Well, I was at the War College, so I'm Joint Special Operations University. I'm still a regular guest lecturer at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, a program they have up there for officers deploying to the Middle East. I may be going to Nigeria first of the year. I was talking to some folks about doing some lecturing in Nigeria, which will be interesting because I've never been to sub-Saharan Africa.
So. Really?
Yes.
How dangerous is it to travel right now, especially in that part of the world?
I don't think it's too dangerous to travel to a place like Nigeria. The biggest fear in Nigeria is probably malaria.
All right. When for folks that may not know, let's start out with some very basic definitions. What is Islam?
Islam is the world's second largest religion behind Christianity. It's always a bit surprising to me. It was a conference back in the summer out in California. A very prominent professor friend of mine, who's Jewish, interestingly enough, so perhaps this is why he wasn't sure about this, but he had thought that Islam was the world's largest religion. And I gave him the stats. I'm like, no, it's not really even close. According to the latest Pew data, which came out last year, about 2.2 billion Christians, about 1.6 billion Muslims. So, world's second largest religion, started about 600 years after Christianity with the founder of Islam, Muhammad, lived in Arabia, and claimed that he was receiving revelations from what he says and what Muslims say is the same God as the Jews and the Christians worship, whom they refer to as Allah. And this religion developed, and basically Islamic doctrines developed the concept that Islam is really sort of the fulfillment. It's what Judaism and Christianity were supposed to have been, according to the Muslims. And the Jews went astray, and then the Christians went astray by deifying Jesus and by believing in things that the Quran rejects, such as the Trinity. So, and then the writings, of course, of Islam were collected at some point after Muhammad's death in 632 AD into a book, the holy book of the Muslims called the Quran. There's also an authoritative body of corpus and material that Muslims refer to called the Hadiths, which are basically sayings of Muhammad that are of, not sayings of God, but sayings of Muhammad. But there are multi-volume collections of these hadiths that Muslims refer to as also part of their, really their sort of revelation almost. And, you know, it's, I mean, that's just the basics about Islam. So it's in many ways very similar to Judaism and Christianity on a world religion sort of sociological analytical paradigm. Islam is classed with the monotheistic religions, Judaism and Christianity, the so-called Western religions. I mean, there are some folks that sometimes refer to Islam as an Eastern religion, but it's really not. It's a Western religion in terms of its monotheism. Eastern religions would be something like Hinduism and Buddhism, which really are polytheistic. They have multiple gods. So it's more in the category of, again, part of, one might argue, the acrimony that exists so often historically between Jews and Christians and Muslims is because in so many ways they're so alike.
And did Muhammad really exist?
Well, I know there are scholars, and most notably a friend of mine who you know and you talk to, and probably a lot of your listeners know, Robert Spencer,
yeah,
who's recently written a book about this. And I just think that's a bridge too far, or that's a thesis too far. I think it's pretty clear that Muhammad existed. You know, Robert has kind of brought back an academic thesis that was discredited 30, 35 years ago and sort of popularized it. But I think one might argue, with due respect to Robert, he can speak for himself, one might argue that even if one is not fully convinced when writing a book that Muhammad didn't exist, it certainly is worthwhile, at least in terms of getting Muslims to try to look at their own origins and applying to Muslims the same sort of historical critical lenses. I'm sure the seminary community there will be thrilled that I use the term historical critical. Historical critical lenses to Islam that have been applied to Christianity for hundreds of years under biblical criticism. Muslims have tended to see themselves as exempt from the same sorts of critical scrutiny that's applied to any other religion in the world, particularly Judaism and Christianity. And so I think I personally think, I mean, Robert's never said this to me, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I personally think that one of the major reasons he would have written a book like that is to get, you know, to sort of sauce for the goose, the sauce for the gander, one might say.
Well, in that sense, it's a good read. I interviewed him about that book, and if nothing else, it's fascinating to look at that thesis and look at the information behind it, come to a conclusion for yourself. But if Muhammad did exist, and we'll run with that for the duration of this program, from where did the Quran come?
Well, no one knows for sure. The traditional Islamic explanation of how their canon of scripture came to be is that just about 20 years after Muhammad's death, the third caliph, a chap named Uthman, realized there was a problem because there were conflicting versions of what they believed to be the revelation given to Muhammad, conflicting written and oral versions of this in various parts of what was by then a growing Islamic empire. And that the caliph at the time, the leader of the Islamic community, caliph means successor to Muhammad, not as prophet, but as military and political leader, which was his other two major roles. This third caliph, Uthman, in the 650s, called sort of a council of everyone who had heard Muhammad preach or had taken notes, or memorized what he'd said, and had them meet in Medina, and had them basically construct an official redacted or edited version of the Quran, which was made authoritative. And then, according to the Islamic sources, he had the caliphal army go out and find any countervailing or any copies that didn't agree with the official version, had them burned. So that's the sort of pious Muslim version. A lot of Western scholars doubt that it happened that neatly. I mean, if you just use it in just terms of comparative history, compare that to how the canon of the New Testament, for instance, came into existence. It took several hundred years for the canon of the New Testament to be accepted by the early church, for the bishops in the early church to say, you know, this is in, you know, Paul's letters are in, these letters of Peter are in, that letter of Hebrews, whoever wrote it, that's in. But the Gospel of Thomas is not in because it has Jesus, you know, making little clay birds that fly up in the air and become alive, or pushing his friend off the roof of a house and bringing him back to life, or, you know, sort of frivolous scary, almost miracles, one might say. Those sorts of books didn't make it into the official canon of Scripture. And this took, you know, certainly over a century. So most scholars don't accept this view that within 20 years of the death of their founder, they had a pristine version of the Quran. It came into existence probably much later, perhaps a century or two later at the earliest. Yeah, but we don't really know. And one of the reasons we don't know is where it happened in Arabia. You cannot go in there, for instance, to do archaeological study because the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and in fact, Islamic states in general, discourage archaeology or studying anything before the time of Islam or early Islam because, well, they have their reasons, but really the real reason is they would be uncomfortable if you uncovered things.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You can reach us by way of email as well, kfuo@kfuo.org. Dr. Timothy R. Furnish, our guest this morning. Tim, we first met because you wrote an article for the Lutheran Witness, the news magazine to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And I guess that was, what, maybe 4 years ago now?
Let's see, Roland. I went to Iran in 2008, and it came out in the January or February 2009 issue.
Yeah, so we're okay, about three or so years ago. And it was called what again?
Dueling Messiahs.
Dueling Messiahs, where you take and you lay side by side the Mahdi and Jesus, right?
Right, in the context of that trip I made to Iran for a conference, yes. Yeah.
So who is Jesus in Islam? Because you often hear that, you know, we love Jesus. You hear them say this on the news. We love your Jesus. But who is he as they would identify him?
Right. Jesus is a prophet in Islam, and in fact, it's the only world religion besides Christianity that has any role for Jesus. I mean, there, I don't know of any. A Jewish friend once said, "Well, Jesus is accepted in Judaism." I said, "Have you run that by your rabbi lately?"
Yeah, it might be a bit of a conflict. Yeah.
I'm not even sure a Reform rabbi would go with that one, but I mean, you sometimes will see sects of Hinduism that say they can sort of shoehorn Jesus as an avatar of, you know, Vishnu, or pick one of the gods in the Hindu pantheon, but really you're sort of that's an artificial construct. Both the Quran and the Hadith talk about Jesus. He is, however, not the same as in Christianity. The Quran explicitly denies the major truths about Jesus that are contained in the Bible. As I mentioned earlier, the Trinity, for instance, the Quran explicitly not just denies but condemns anyone who believes in a Trinity. Of course, the Trinity, as it's posed and as it's set up in the Quran, is really sort of a caricature. The Trinity, as the Quran seems to understand it, which seems to reflect, I believe, Muhammad's misunderstanding, the Trinity is God the Father, Mary, and Jesus.
Hmm.
So it's really sort of a profound. They set up basically a straw Trinity and knock it down. As for Jesus himself, the words into Jesus' mouth where he denies that he's the Son of God. He is called Masih, al-Masih in Arabic, which is basically the transliteration of Mashiach, the Hebrew Mashiach, Messiah, into Arabic. But it doesn't mean the same thing. It's simply a title, really sort of stripped of any meaning.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, Jesus basically is made in the Quran to ridicule anyone that believes he is the Son of God. And then most importantly, the Quran explicitly denies that Jesus was crucified and resurrected. Interestingly enough, the Quran says Jesus, one that was made to look like him, was crucified in his place, and that never really explains it. It has been exegeted by Islamic scholars. Many of them believe that Judas was actually crucified as punishment for betraying Jesus. Jesus, meanwhile, ascended directly to heaven without dying and will return in the same way. So it's Jesus with a whole lot of major differences. I mean, such that it's really a different Jesus in the Quran than in the New Testament.
And in their version, what is the role of Jesus in the eschaton?
Jesus comes back. He is one of two good eschatological figures, the other one being the Mahdi, the rightly guided one, who's really the main figure. And Jesus, along with who is called Isa in the Arabic Quran, Jesus and the Mahdi, the rightly guided one, will come to earth. Jesus will return. Now, in Sunni Islam, the Mahdi, again, the main eschatological figure, has never been here yet. There have been, and my first book was about this, and We've talked about this. There have been numerous people in Islamic history over 1,400 years that have claimed to be the Mahdi. And sometimes, you mentioned, where's Charles Gordon when you need him? In 1881, for example, in 1881 in Sudan, we were talking about Sudan a moment ago.
Yeah.
There was a fellow named Muhammad Ahmed that claimed he was the Mahdi and got thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people convinced that he was, and they fought against the Egyptians and the at that time the British troops that were there and killed them, and Charles Gordon was a British general sent in to try to stave this off, and he wound up being killed too. So there have been numerous dozens, if not hundreds, of people in Islamic history that have claimed to be this Mahdi in the Sunni world. But they're always believed to be, of course, the false one, what's called a Muta Mahdi, the false one. Now, where this idea about the Mahdi is sort of more theologically, I guess you could say, routinized, is in particularly in Shiism, and particularly Twelver Shiism, which is the branch of Shia Islam in Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon. And they're called Twelvers because they believe that after Muhammad, there were 12 imams, or rightful leaders of the Islamic community, starting with Muhammad's son-in-law and cousin named Ali. And for the next 150 years or so, there were 12 of these imams. Finally, in the 9th century, this one imam, who was named Muhammad, who was a young boy, is claimed to have gone into sort of a mystical state of hiding or occultation. In Arabic, the word is ghaiba. I think, as a historian and as a Christian, I think it's pretty clear that this kid just died. And since a five-year-old kid, pretty hard for a five-year-old kid to have any children, this branch of Islam would have died out. So the Twelvers came up with this elaborate ruse, frankly, that he had not died but had gone into what they call this occultation. And they believe that this kid, who disappeared in 874 A.D., will return as the 12th Imam, the Mahdi, in Islam. And again, I had to throw that in because it's very hard to understand this without explaining that a little bit. But basically, for the Sunnis, the Mahdi, for the Twelvers, the 12th Imam, al-Mahdi, will work with Jesus to basically make the whole world Muslim. That will be the role of Jesus and the Mahdi in the eschaton.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Tim, let's take some calls. Nancy, good morning. You're up with Dr. Furnish first.
Hello.
Nancy, you're up. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I read The 12th Imam, or whatever it is, by Joel Rosenberg, and he's wrote quite a few books. He's a converted Christian. He's Jewish, and he converted to Christianity, and he's wrote a lot of good books. I have decided, especially after reading that book, that this is a satanic religion. What kind of faith tells you to go around and murder anybody who will not accept your faith? And so, thereby, I think Satan is actually who is behind this religion. I know there's a lot of nice Muslims. However, when you see things like that are going on over in the Mideast, especially where they're crucifying even the Christians, I can't believe that this is nothing but a religion that Satan has come and disguised himself as and convinced all these millions of people. Look at the theories he has on Jesus and everything else. So I will never accept them. In fact, they start brainwashing these children from day as soon as they're born, practically.
All right, Nancy, hang on for a second, because that's a plateful. Tim, things we've discussed before, but go ahead and do you consider it to be a satanic religion? Tim, you still with us?
Right.
Yeah.
Let me back up just a little bit there. She talked about Joel Rosenberg. For the listeners who don't know, Joel Rosenberg is very successful fiction writer. He was an advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu at one point, and I guess had converted from Judaism to evangelical Christianity. Was sort of a regular when Glenn Beck had that show on Fox News. Used to have Rosenberg on a lot.
Right.
Well, my problem with this view as a Lutheran is I don't necessarily share the evangelical Christian exegetical paradigm of, and I think as Lutherans we don't officially, actually, maybe we shouldn't, share the view of the Christian eschatological books, Revelation and others, that evangelical Christians might share. I also have, I'm struggling with how to answer this in a good way, Roland, because I wear several hats. I'm a Christian, I'm a Lutheran, I'm also a historian, and I'm also an analyst for the government. Let me put it this way. I think that the problems that Islam poses in terms of violence, which we see happening right now in our embassies and the unfortunate killing of the ambassador and several other people, I think the problems that Islam poses on the world stage can be explained quite satisfactorily and responded to if we were to have the guts to do it, which I don't think we do in this administration, the intellectual honesty and the guts, without recourse to calling it a satanic religion. I totally sympathize with and understand Nancy's viewpoint on this. The problem is that to call something satanic is, I think, to sort of label it such that there are no exceptions. Is Islam the most violent religion in the world? I think clearly, if you read the Quran, and not just that, because one can read the Old Testament and find some pretty violent passages in the Old Testament.
Oh, yeah.
But there is no global movement of Orthodox Jews going around citing the Old Testament in order to perpetrate violence on other people. And in fact, there's not even a global movement of evangelical Christians doing that. There is, however, a global transnational movement of a religion that cites the Quran to do such things. Now, does that mean all 1.6 billion people do that? No. But it's very problematic, and many people in this religion do this, but not all. There are sects and strains of Islam, denominations, if you will, that eschew the violence. And some of which we've talked about before, the Ismailis, who are a sect of the Shia, who are not the Twelvers, who specific, and they're a fairly small sect, but globally they have about 15 or 20 million people, East Africa, the Indian subcontinent, a number in England. In fact, the head of this branch of Islam, the Aga Khan, lives in London. This group officially, for centuries, has said that, for instance, jihad does not mean killing other people, which, to be fair, is how it is still defined to this day in Sunni Islam. The first and primary meaning of jihad is to kill other people. So the Ismailis don't accept that definition and reject it. The Ahmadis, who are another sect of Islam that are often persecuted in places like Pakistan and Indonesia, also define Islam as peaceful. And legitimately, I mean, not the people that you sometimes see on certain news outlets who will say Islam is peaceful while winking at the burning embassies. I mean, these are people that I've studied their writings and talked to some of them. They legitimately believe this. Now, they are a minority. But I think the fact that such people exist, that such Muslims do exist, and it's undeniable they do exist, I think is a standing rebuke to the idea that Islam has to be violent. And this is sort of a splitting hairs argument, but I think it's an important one to be made, and I try to make it constantly, and it can't be made in few words, so forgive me. Islam does have peaceful sects. Now, they are a minority, but they do exist. Now, as a Christian, it has occurred to me, and this is an old trope. This was advanced back in the medieval church, back when, even before the Crusades.
Well, I tell you what, Tim. Let's come back to that trope in just a moment, because we do have to take a break here. Yes. We also have Herman on the line who has a question for you as well. We'll get to him after you finish that thought. You can join us at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. My very good friend, Dr. Timothy Furnish, is with us today. He's an expert in all things Islamic history and theology. We're going to spend some time with this expert trying to figure out what's going on in the world right now. We'll be right back. Stick around. Good morning and welcome back. We continue our discussion with Dr. Timothy Furnish about, well, I guess you could term this all things Islam today. We'll get into some of the events that are taking place around the globe this week in just a moment. But, Tim, you wanted to finish your thought about this trope you were talking about from medieval times.
The medieval church. One of the beliefs in the medieval church among some of the theologians who knew something about Islam, and this was reported in repeated, I should say, in Western literature in a number of different places, such as Dante, was that Muhammad was inspired by Satan to create sort of a false, somewhat similar but quite different gospel. And I certainly have sympathy for that view. What prevents me from sort of going whole hog, no pun intended, into that is that, again, there are some sects of Islam that in which you see some good things being done. And again, and this is where some of my conservative friends might dislike me for this, and it's kind of funny because, and we can talk about this later, it's so politicized. It's not funny, it's actually tragic. So politicized to talk about this issue. If you dare to say there's anything wrong or anything violent, inherently violent in Islam, you're an Islamophobe. But for some folks on what I consider to be my side of the fence, the other side, if you dare to say there might be something good in Islam, you're somehow treasonous or something. There is good in Islam, and I'm not saying this with sort of the typical addled, you know, liberal Christian view, you know, everyone's good or something. I think there's more violence and evil done in the name of Islam than any other ideology today in the world, including leftism. But I'm not willing to ascribe it to Satan when I see that there is, with all of the badness and evil and clear anti-Christian, anti-Jewish teachings in the Quran, there are sometimes right side by side next to those are ones that are positive. And I see some groups of Muslims acting on those and trying to reject the negative stuff. Are they a minority? Yes. Are they a small minority in percentage-wise? Yes. But they do exist. And this is what prevents me from going and saying that Islam is satanic.
Would they be a viable counterforce to the violent side of Islam?
Well, one would hope. I think they are more feasible as a counterforce to the burning embassy mobs than are sort of what the chimera we're always chasing, which is the moderate Sunni. The problem with finding moderate Sunnis is in Sunnism, which is the mainstream branch of Islam, makes up about 85% of Muslims, so it's, you know, 900 million or more people. And one can understand why the State Department and other people say, well, this is where we have to find the so-called moderates, because they're by far the largest branch. But the problem is, again, that in Sunni Islam, it is not acceptable to read the Quran and the Hadiths any way other than 100% literally.
Right. Yeah.
So when the mobs go wild and say, you've insulted the Prophet Muhammad, we must kill you, they're not just making that up, and it's frankly not even accurate to call them extremists, because they aren't extremists. They're extremists perhaps in that they wish to perpetrate violence, but they aren't extremists in their understanding of Islam. They're actually quite mainstream and Sunni in their understanding, because Islam has taught for years. The Quran itself teaches that to fight those who basically fight against or argue against Islam and the Prophet. So they aren't doing anything that's wildly off base from what their religion teaches. The problem is that they are taught in Sunni Islam, again, here, let me make the seminary professors happy, the only exegetical paradigm that you're supposed to apply to the Quran in Sunnism is a literalist one. Some of these groups that I'm talking about, and ironically enough, believe it or not, the 12 are Shia in Iran and Iraq, believe that you don't have to read the Quran literally, that you can sometimes allegoricize it or turn it into symbol or metaphor or that sort of thing. So that's the problem. The problem is in Sunni Islam, people talk about having an enlightenment in Sunni Islam, but they haven't even gotten to the Reformation part yet, or even the Renaissance. They have quite a ways to go before they, in the main branch of Islam, one could sort of step away from these literalist readings, which are quite often violent.
505-7850-1800-730-2727. Tim Herman has been waiting patiently. Thank you, Herman, for your call this morning.
Thank you. Yes, Dr. Furnish, you mentioned you had been to Iran and noticed that the president of Ahmadinejad of Iran and the Ayatollahs around him have seemed to propose that they are more or less desire to be the leading voices of Islam, particularly vis-a-vis the use of, say, their atomic weapons or missiles against the non-Islamic world to bring in the Mahdi. And around the world, there seems to be also a fallout with Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups over who is the true Islamic leader politically against the infidel world, and they don't hesitate to shoot missiles and guns at each other along the way to do that. It's what happened with Iran, Iraq, and war a while back. How do you see this instability of the acclaim of who's the real leader in the world of Islam charismatically? And as you mentioned about the Mahdi and Khartoum and Sudan and the Charles Garden era, it seems to be very unstable. One group will claim one thing, and then there's a counterclaim by another.
Yeah, that's a very good question, Herman. And really, I think there's two parts there. The first part is about this idea of what they call in the analytical circles I run in, hotwiring the apocalypse. And then the other issue was, what about legitimate authority in Islam, and why is there fighting over this? I think it's two different issues, if I understood this correctly. This hotwiring the apocalypse idea, which this is the idea that has been adduced, and Joel Richardson is another friend of mine who's written a book called The Islamic Antichrist. Joel Rosenberg is one of the people that I think, unfortunately, has let his propensity to sell books get ahead of his sort of quest for analytical truth here. And again, the fact, Herman, that you bring this up, it's indicative of how strongly this idea has become entrenched in popular circles. I mean, I don't know if you're Lutheran or evangelical, but particularly in evangelical Christian circles, this has become sort of an article of faith, that the Iranians want to blow up Tel Aviv and hopefully not get too much fallout on Jerusalem, blow up Tel Aviv and wipe out Israel in order to spark the coming of the 12th Imam. I don't believe this. I don't think this is right. I don't think this is a proper reading of 12 or Shia Islamic doctrines. I've studied this in a number of venues. I've written on it. I don't think this accurately reflects the viewpoint of the Ayatollahs. Again, and not to sound like a liberal, because trust me, I'm not, but If you look at what they have said over the years, Ahmadinejad and Khamenei and others, they have said that Israel will be wiped from the face of the earth, and Israel will be erased from the pages of history, and other things like that, which are pretty disturbing. But if you compare that, if you put that in the context of what 12 or Shia theology teaches about the coming of the 12th Imam, I think it's clear that they're saying when the 12th Imam comes, he'll get rid of Israel. They're not saying that they can do anything to cause his coming, all right? Now, there are people, there are Muslims that believe that you could do something horrendous, some sort of cataclysmic event, generally understood to be something with a nuclear weapon against the Israelis and or us, in order to spark the coming of the Mahdi. But these are some of the Sunni jihadist groups. I think some of the members, there was some evidence a few years ago that some of the members of Al-Qaeda believed this. I'm not sure whether Bin Laden was into this or not, but some of the membership in Al-Qaeda seems to believe that, and some of the other Sunni jihadist groups seem to believe this. So I think that idea is operative, but I do not think it's operative when applied to Iran. So that's my view on that. The second issue was political authority and religious authority in Islam and why there's so much fighting about it. Well, there's always been fighting about it. It's kind of funny. One of the or the solution that most of the Sunni groups will say that will solve this sort of political fragmentation and religious fragmentation of the Ummah, the Islamic community, is bringing back a caliphate, bringing back some sort of caliph. But these guys are just showing how ignorant they are of history, because even if you go back in Islamic history, the time period when the Islamic Empire, the rule of Muslims, was under one guy, was lasted about, I don't know, 12 minutes on the historical stage, tops. Very early in Islamic history, it split into multiple warring caliphates. I mean, this sort of pious notion, this pious fiction that when they had a caliphate, you know, Islam was this great empire and we all got along and, you know, those Jews and Christians knew their place. Well, that part of it's probably true. But the rest of it is simply not true. I mean, from early on in Islamic history, there were multiple caliphates. You had a guy in Baghdad claiming to be the caliph. You had another guy in, way over in Spain after they conquered. Well, it wasn't Spain yet. The Iberian Peninsula. You had a guy in Egypt claiming to be the caliph. You know, so there, and in West Africa, there were multiple caliphs after Islam came there. So it's just sort of this pious fiction. It's kind of silly. But that said, there are a number of Islamic groups. Al-Qaeda is one of them, a group that doesn't engage in as much violence, but I think is ideologically much more threatening, called Hizb ut-Tahrir, Party of Liberation, believes this. Many of these Islamic groups believe that if they could unite even some portion of the Islamic world under one guy's rule, they would be much better off. Now, for the Twelvers, they don't believe in the caliphate because they believe that the Sunni caliphs were illegitimate rulers. As I mentioned earlier, they believe that the only legitimate rulers of the Islamic world was this line of imams descended from Muhammad through his son-in-law and cousin Ali. And to this day, the only legitimate ruler of the Islamic world could be someone in that line of descent, or really, I mean, what now has become this mystical idea, the return of the 12th imam. So the Sunnis and the Shia have sort of different views on who should be in charge. I mean, their ideal is that there be one guy, you know, in charge of everything from Morocco to Malaysia. But I really don't see that happening in history. It was never, of course, that extensive anyway, but there were periods when large fragments or large sections of the Islamic world were under one guy's rule. I mean, the most prominent example, which existed up until the early 20th century, was the Ottoman Empire, in which there was one guy in charge. But even there, he didn't rule the whole Islamic world. There were different Islamic states over in India, different Islamic states in West Africa, and that sort of thing.
I see. So the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt right now, and these other movements, they each have aspirations, but they can't necessarily really unify because of their own diverse motives and personalities.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is interesting. You know, Al-Ikhwan al-Muslimin, the Muslim Brothers, was started back in the 1920s by an Egyptian guy, Hassan al-Banna. And the primary goal of the Muslim Brotherhood has not been so much political unity of Muslims as it's been sort of a re-Islamation of society. Hassan al-Banna's view, which you still see down to this day with people like Mohamed Morsi, the president of Egypt, was that their societies, mainly under Western influence, but to a certain extent also when the Arabs were ruled by the Ottomans, had become sort of bad Muslims or lax Muslims, and they had incorporated too many ideas from the West, you know, prominent of which, of course, was the idea of secularism. And that you really need a sort of a grassroots movement in the schools and in the families from the bottom up to make societies more Muslim. And then if you did this for a generation or two, eventually it would be a truly Muslim society again. And then whoever they elected leader out of such a society would ipso facto be a legitimate Muslim leader, whether you called him the caliph or not. The Muslim Brotherhood is careful never to call for a caliph or a caliphate, which is the office thereof. The Muslim Brotherhood, however, if you look at their documents in Arabic, they basically want the same thing. The Muslim Brotherhood's documents call for a Dawla, what is it, Dawla Alamiya Islamiya, a global Islamic state. They never use the term caliph, which I think is very calculated on their part. So one could argue, really, when you get down to it, the goals of Al-Qaeda and the goals of the Muslim Brotherhood, this is what I think you may have been getting at, Herman, the goals of the Muslim Brotherhood and of groups like Al-Qaeda are really not different. They just have a different view of how to get there. The Muslim Brotherhood, I will argue with people vigorously about this, vehemently. The Muslim Brotherhood is not a terrorist organization. They are an Islamist organization, in many ways more dangerous. We are never going to be defeated militarily by these Muslim groups. It's just not going to happen, right? Ideologically, I'm not so sure. because there are many people, as we see, active in this administration, advising this administration. They're telling people the goals of the Muslim Brotherhood, there's nothing wrong with them. Well, perhaps not in Egypt, where pew after pew poll shows that a majority of people in Egypt support things like the imposition of Sharia law and stoning for adultery and the amputation of your hands for stealing. Now, if the society, 84% of the people in that society want that and want to elect a government that puts that into power, well, then that's fine. But I'm not sure that we should give such a government $1.8 billion a year.
Yeah.
Herman, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before we go to Bob, Tim, let me read you some of the headlines that are off the AP Wire copy right now. North Dakota State University has been evacuated after a bomb threat. There's an unspecified threat right now at Valparaiso University. Apparently an Al-Qaeda threat has shut down the University of Texas. There's a mob at the embassy in London burning American flags. Protesters are smashing windows in Tunisia. Gunfire has been heard at the embassy in Sudan, and the German embassy in Sudan is on fire. It's an interesting world in which we live, is it not?
It's you know, it's, as we talked about before, recently, it's 1979 redux, but sort of 1979 on steroids.
Oh, my, yes.
Because in 1979, we had a president in office who, albeit rather feckless, was not effectively pro-Muslim. I mean, do I think Barack Obama is a Muslim? No. But I think his policies sometimes are so indistinguishable from those that a Muslim president would institute, I don't see much difference. I mean, the first one can blame, it's interesting to watch the media try to make this out to be an issue for Mitt Romney, but one, you know, the within hours of the embassy being attacked, the embassy in Cairo, the United States embassy, is putting out statements apologizing for this quote-unquote offensive Muhammad film, and basically acting in the status of what, under Islamic law, is called a dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I, which is a Jew or Christian who is a second-class citizen under Islamic law, who basically is, under Islamic law, supposed to be craven. This is how our embassy was acting. And I know State Department people. I've interacted with them before, and their first impulse is, you know, and I'm glad that it is, their first impulse is to try to head off a fight, to head off a conflict, to try to be nice. But that statement basically just abandoned, even laying aside what one thinks about Christianity and Islam, that statement basically abandons something we have called the First Amendment. And it basically says that Islamic mobs, in their raging and pillaging and killing and murdering and burning, will intimidate us into abandoning basically any segments of the Constitution that Muslim mobs don't like. This is absurd. Now, the president, you know, 12 hours or 8 hours later, repudiated this and said that it wasn't the White House policy, but hey, he's sitting at the desk. The buck stops there. It was his ambassador that he appointed that allowed this to be put out, as well as his ambassador in Cairo, as you probably saw, Roland, that ordered that the Marine guards not have any live rounds with their weapons.
Yeah, I did say that. Hey, let's go back to the phones very quickly here, because a couple of folks have been waiting very long for you, very patiently. Bob, you're next. Thanks for the patience.
Hello. My wife and I have had frequent contact with Pakistani Muslims through a catering business. And we've often served in the local mosque and very often in homes at Islamic weddings, birthday parties, things like that. Prior to this experience, about 8 years ago, I had a student dentist where I was getting bridges. It took about 4 months. And before I went to see her each time, I did a little study in Islam and prepared a little sound bite to say just before I got in the chair, to prime the pump of conversation, which she loved to do. And she said to me after a few times, "My parents would love you. You make me think about my religion." And I thought, well, they wouldn't if they knew what I was doing. And I didn't speak about Christianity at all for 3.5 months. I only talked to her about her religion. Just, I prepare a sign by, and of course, I ended up knowing more than she did, but she was American-born. Her parents were not. But the whole goal was indeed to get her to think about her religion so that she would examine it for herself. And I think that they need to examine what it really says and let them react in their human nature against it. And to fast forward 3.5 months later, she said, I'll never forget you, when we were about to be finished. And the next time I said, you know, I found out today, which was the truth, I found out today that I'm going to hell. And she said, you're not going to hell, you're a good person. I said, no, I read today that I'm going to hell. You're not going to hell, you're a good person. I said, well, I read in the Quran that if I believe that Jesus is the Son of God, I'm going to go to hell. And you know I do. And she gasped and looked at the floor and said, one of us is going to hell. And I never got to further explain the gospel, but my whole goal was, she was a nominal Muslim like most are, and I think that's probably part of what you're, where you're coming from about many, many Islamic people. God provided this on a, you know, outside of the Muslim culture through a, you know, sort of a business relationship. And in working with Pakistanis with the catering business, I see what a wall there is, how they are sewn up, being prevented from hearing the gospel. And when you say, is Islamic satanic, and say no, well, I think of the Apostle Peter when Jesus said, get behind me, Satan. What you have in mind is not from God, but man, when Peter opposed his going to the cross. So at that moment, you know, Peter had satanic thoughts. It wasn't true. But that wasn't his, that wasn't the Apostle Peter in the mainstream. And of course, he repented. Just read his letters.
Bob, thank you for the call. We're running very short on time. We have one more call to get to. Tim, any comments?
No, that's very interesting. I mean, I think that's a wonderful approach Bob took, because he's exactly right. Many people that are raised Muslim really don't know that much about what their religion actually teaches. I mean, I've had Muslims argue with me that it doesn't say things that it clearly says about, you know, beheading infidels, or the hadiths don't say that Muhammad married a six-year-old girl and had sex with her when she was 9 years old, and the Islamic sources clearly say this. So I think, Bob, that was a very, very, very good approach. The best thing is to, it seems to me, is to actually do build these sorts of personal relationships, and then you pose a question, a knowledgeable question like he did, that throws open the conflict that they find themselves in. I think that's a very brilliant approach that Bob used.
Right, one more quick caller. Larry, you've only got about 2 minutes, so if you could be real quick for us. Hang on 1 second here. There you go, Larry. Go ahead.
First of all, I always refer to Scripture first. You had a question about whether this religion is satanic. In Revelation, it talks about the three great woes against Christianity: 4th century Arianism, 7th century Islam, Mohammedism, and Catholicism. What I'm about to say, I've read and I find very controversial, and I want to know if your guest has ever ran into this in his studies. Okay. Islam and the rise of Mohammed was the invention of the Roman Catholic Church, as Mohammed married a widow who was Roman Catholic, and basically the Roman Catholic Church has tried to get Islam to do its bidding. And one quick question, don't you find it very curious, Roland and your guest, that through all this, the Pope has remained mum?
All right, we've got 1 minute left.
Larry, that's simply not true. The Pope just the other day put out a statement about decrying the killing of the ambassador and the violence. Pope Benedict has a number of times called out Islam on this topic, going back to the Regensburg speech in 2006, where he got in all kinds of hot water with Muslims for calling Islam an irrational religion. There were no Catholics in the Arabian Peninsula, Larry, in the 7th century A.D. That was an Orthodox Christian area, or actually other Eastern churches that were considered heretical, Monophysite, Nestorian, and so on. There were no Catholics that anyone knows of.
Yeah, it was a Gnostic stronghold.
In Central Arabia. I know that particularly in our church, among the sort of old guard, we're still fighting some of these 16th century battles. But I have a hard time thinking that the Catholic Church is in league with Islam, considering the Catholic Church, for all of its faults, still preaches, last time I checked, Christ crucified and resurrected, both of which Islam denies.
Dr. Timothy R. Furnish has been our guest. Professor, writer, expert in Islamic history and theology, writes for the History News Network, Pajamas Media. Check out his work at Mahdi Watch, MAHDIWatch.org. And what's the name of the book, Tim, that you wrote?
Holiest Wars.
Holiest Wars. We'll check that out. Have a great weekend. Thank you for your time. We'll talk some more off air. All right, guys, have a great weekend. We're back on Monday. See you then.
Listen to the Bible Study Monday through Friday at this same time. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is heard weekdays on KFUO Radio, a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.